Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our roundtable panel on this Monday, the 13th of November. Very nice to have you with us. It is a delight as always. And we welcome you. We welcome your letters and we welcome your participation in our program this morning. Let me introduce the panel to you and we will get started and talk about what's going on in our world today. Let us begin with David Soares. He is the two-mic'd man here. He is the... Do you want them on four or five? Five. All right. I'm going to move four. Because otherwise it looks like you have a dental procedure going on there, sir.
Or I have a lot to say.
Yeah, well, we like that in our panelists. With that, we want. David Soares is the Albany County District Attorney. We are thrilled that he is a regular on our program, and we welcome to the proceedings this morning.
Thank you very much.
Also with us this morning is the chairman of the Capital District Latinos, Dan Irizarry, who has been with us before. This is his second time back. We are thrilled that he has... come back. And Dan, it's very good to see you. How have you been?
I've been doing well, doing some college visits and with my son. And so we have our fingers crossed and look forward to what the future holds.
That does become a whole, like that becomes all
consuming,
all encompassing. Yep. as a project. We're doing Absolutely. That now with my nephew. Now it's quite a big thing.
Deal. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Well, congratulations.
Fingers crossed.
Does he have one that he's really?
He's got some reaches and he's got some more logical close by.
All right. Well,
decisions. Yeah.
Good luck. That's I'm sure it'll all work out for the best. Alan Chartok is with us, fresh from a beautiful evening Saturday night at the Egg with Harry Belafonte. It was first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
And second of all, congratulations. It was a beautiful, beautiful evening.
He is such a special man.
Oh God.
I mean, you gotta love him. I'll tell you right now. And philosophically, boy, is he on. I decided to keep my questions short. So the first question I asked him was, Trump.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And he went off to the races.
Boy, did he ever.
Yeah.
He was great.
It was a very special evening. So we thank all of our folks who came out and support, mm-hmm. and I know they had a wonderful evening. And so thank you. Let us get to what is happening in the world today. And, where to begin?
Oh, Lord.
Anybody have any requests? Where would you like to start off? I think I would like to start off with the Asia trip, Trump's Asia trip and coming back. The headline in the New York Times is, after Discipline Week in Asia, Trump unloads on critics. For the last week on the road, President Trump had been measured, disciplined, and studiously scripted as he picked his way through the geopolitical minefields of Asia. And then came the weekend. In a stream of tweets on Sunday, the president said those who wanted to investigate his ties in Russia were haters and fools. He ridiculed crooked Hillary Clinton's ill-fated effort to reset relations with Russia and fired back at North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. calling him old, saying that he could call Mr. Kim short and fat, but had restrained himself, as he calls him short and fat.
Yes, this is the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Heading over to Asia for discussions that will ultimately result in policies that affect not only the United States, but the rest of the globe.
And one of the things that Harry said, David, which was so interesting in this conversation we had the other night, was, and with the prospect of turning our skins into carbon.
Yes.
Boy, was that was pretty strong language.
That gets to it.
That followed a freewheeling session with reporters on Air Force One on Saturday, in which Mr. Trump dismissed the Russia investigations as a Democratic hit job, derided as political hacks. Three former chiefs of the nation's intelligence agencies, all three of which concluded that Russia had meddled in the 2016 presidential election. So the president comes out and says, look, I talked to Putin. And Putin says he didn't do anything. He didn't collude. So who are you going to believe? Well, why wouldn't you believe this guy? This is what he says. Wait, didn't he? There was no collusion. I just asked him, and he said there's no collusion. Then reporters doing their job said, So, excuse me, Mr. President, are you believing the leader of a foreign government over your own intelligence sources? And I think he had to think about that for a moment, but then said, well, I have questioned them in the past, meaning that morning.
Yeah.
But I do believe in what they say now.
Yeah, it's an afternoon of reckless statements and an evening of backpedaling and trying to find a way out of the comments that were previously made. I mean, I think anyone who had any hope that Mr. Kelly was going to come along and provide any discipline in the White House, as a matter of fact, I couldn't help but read an article in which Mr. Kelly was quoted as saying that, you know, he doesn't bother with the tweets. He doesn't look at them, and neither does anyone else in the staff look at the tweets, except
the and I'm sorry to just add to this, but he said I chose not to follow the president's tweets, so he's not even a follower, which I think is great.
But it's funny, isn't it? You're not following the tweets, and yet you and your staff and everyone else work aggressively the vast majority of the time to clean up the statements that are being made. On those tweets.
So let's assume for a second that's true. Well, of course it's not, but let's assume it's true. And the general doesn't follow the tweets. Does this mean 7 days in May or whatever else that the general is the real president and that the other guy is ignored?
That's a frightening prospect when you surround yourself with so many generals and they're part of the administration. Doesn't it begin to look like the military is in charge? And that's the frightening, sinking feeling you get when you see some of this reporting about who's, you know, restraining the president.
I agree with you. I do think, though, that the point that Kelly was making was ultimately a good one, which is, look, we have to do the work of the White House. We have to do the work, and we're preparing for the trip. It went this well for this long because we did our preparation, we did our homework, and we can't be distracted by all of this outside stuff.
Except I'm going to throw a wrench into that idea.
There's a lot of wrenches to be thrown, by the way.
From Asia, he says to his Secretary of Homeland Security, is it?
Yes.
Why aren't you deporting the Hondurans? Why isn't this happening faster? So we have the general who doesn't follow the tweets, but he's interested from Asia as to why immigrants are not being deported fast enough. Where is the logic here? I'm sort of missing it. I don't get it.
Well, one of the pieces of logic, I think, is that we are expected to believe that the president, according to Kelly, that the president's words have no meaning or import. In other words, let him tweet because he's just the president of the United States. He's going to meet with Duterte and one another strong man who he admires, another dictator, because in each of these cases, I'm sorry, we could project the idea that what his admiration for these guys is that's what he wants to be.
I will tell you that there could a number of things could happen for the remainder of this calendar year, but I will tell you that the image of the President of the United States with the American flag in the backdrop sitting next to Duterte is an image that I'm not going to be forgetting anytime soon.
That's for sure.
A man who engages in extrajudicial killings and is so proud to say that, you know, in public spaces it's something that we've never seen before from an American president. And so this trip could be summarized as calamitous. I mean, the only difference between this week and any other week is that we haven't had him here. But in terms of the chaos that he causes and in terms of the amount of attention that he draws to himself, that's continued to happen.
Well, I love having you on the show, David, because, you know, you're a man of the law. And I'm fascinated by the idea that he would go sit next to Duterte and say, you know, you're a guy who is solving your drug problem basically, because he's basically endorsing him, the right way,
absolutely,
which is you're killing the people who are either using the stuff or selling the stuff.
The man who said you know, not too long ago, because everything that he said, quite honestly, is not too long ago. We're in the month of November, and the man started in January. But it's the man who recently said, criticized the criminal justice process here in the United States is taking too long. And you actually sit back, and if you think about it and reflect about on it, he is a bit envious that other nations, you know, clean up their quote unquote problems a little swifter than we do, failing to appreciate the constitutional protections that we enjoy here in this country.
But he's also, I'm sorry, Joe, but he's also going to the base at the same time, which is, sure, just kill him. Just kill these people. But what's really dangerous is, since words do matter, you have a president of the United States who is encouraging this kind of behavior. So if you're a police officer in a particular place, you get the idea that the president has just said, take the gloves off, do whatever you want.
Well, you know, what's happening, I think, that a lot of people are not paying attention, as with so much in this government, is that they're rolling back, you know, some of the progress that has been made on things like sentencing. So you have Jeff Sessions with this desire to renew the war on drugs and to lock them up, because that was, after all, one of the chants we heard throughout the election or the campaign. Only this time, they're going to start locking people up in droves like they used to in the good old days, when we've been walking away from that and saying treatment is what people need, not incarceration. So while he's out there with Duterte, Jeff Sessions is back home doing his thing.
The war on pot is back on, from the Department of Justice. And as you're saying, we're arriving at this place of enlightenment. I mean, over the weekend we had our governor acknowledge the usefulness of medical marijuana, as he's prepared to make more medical marijuana available to veterans and people who experience
PTSD,
trauma,
right,
as well as law enforcement. And here we have our federal government, you know, relaunching a failed war from the early 70s.
Absolutely. And that's disgusting.
You're talking a moment ago of the signals there of sitting there and talking about the drug war. But even in that tweet, when he was calling Kim Jong-un short and fat, or not calling him that, while calling him that, he said, I've worked so hard to be friends with him. Well, we didn't ask for that, did we? Did we ask for him to be friends? Like, is that the relationship we want them to have?
You know, that would be his idea of engaging in diplomacy. I mean, that, you know,
really?
making a claim. So again, it's speaking to his base, demonstrating that he's making an effort. But there has been little to no evidence supporting that he's made any gesture whatsoever to engage in diplomatic relationships with North Korea. But I will say the one thing about his comments, the short and fat comments, he certainly is providing Melania, who was taken to cyberbullying as her pet project, he's certainly providing her with enough opportunities to provide education there.
Yes, to give examples.
Yeah.
And some in this New York Times article this morning indicated that when things seemed to go off the rails is when she went home. She was there at the trip for the first several days, and then after Beijing left, and that was sort of when you started to get all of the tweets and the torrent on Saturday.
How many Trump whisperers do we need to have in one administration?
Well,
we have John Kelly, we have Melania. Is anybody going to come forward who's the next Trump whisperer?
I'm not saying that we should have them, but I think in the interim, as many as it takes, right?
Yeah.
So
that's
if you're,
one way to look at it.
So if you're Kelly and you're looking at your own career, which we tend to do sometimes, right? We say, well, what's here? What's next? What will happen to – woe is me. What will happen to me?
What the hell have I done?
If this guy goes, what are you thinking? Are you thinking that it's so – that you had better put some space between you and him? Hence the tweeting comments, because you want to save yourself for whatever comes next. I don't think it'll work. I mean, I think when these guys, we saw it with Nixon and everything else, they'll be out.
Oh, yeah.
They won't be able to save themselves.
It's just a matter of time before they
The general the general destroyed himself 2 to 3 weeks ago.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the comments that were made in reference to the Civil War, to me, just destroyed any credibility that John Kelly had. And now he's become part of the cartoonish, you know, apparatus that we've all become so familiar with in the White House.
It's a rock and the hard place. Now, you can believe that before he made those ridiculous, stupid, insulting comments about Lee and others, that he was called into the Oval Office and said, you better do this. You just better do it.
Yeah.
Don't you think? And that he had to do it.
This was a significant trip. It's a significant trip discussing, you know, the future economies of the globe. Does anyone here believe that anything was accomplished during this trip? I mean, this is the man who waxed poetically on the stupidity of the previous administrations for even engaging in the TPP. He's, you know, decried, you know, the virtues of NAFTA. And so he's heading into...
Meanwhile, he's giving the administration in China basically a hegemony over trade by stepping away from TPP. So now China's like, we're the big dog on the street now. We bark louder than you.
I'm going to pause you there because we have to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We'll have letters. We'll talk about other issues that are happening in the news and find out what's happening. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning and welcome. Thank you very much for being with us on the roundtable panel this morning. Alan Chartok is here, Dan Irizarry, and David Soares, and we welcome your letters. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org.
You know, Joe, I'm fascinated by the control of the United States Senate. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on which could really change the control of this House, which is theirs by the Republicans by two votes. You got the Menendez trial going on in New Jersey, and it certainly looks from what excused jurors and others have said that Menendez is getting off. So that's one more vote. And one wonders whether anybody in that jury knows anything about national politics and knows how momentous that decision will be as to whether or not. And then, of course, you've got another little Southern problem with Roy Moore right
now. More problems. More
problems.
More, more.
Who's now this morning announced that he was, would
sue.
Thinking of suing the Washington Post over their initial coverage, even though
he ain't going to do it.
Many other news agencies have corroborated those stories and have also extended them a bit as well. But
he's not going to do it. I mean, you know, as David Soares, the brilliant legal analyst, and I mean that, has said to me before. You sue, and you got to go before you got to open up yourself
You're opening yourself up to depositions, and you're going to, you know, the press is going to, you know, the truth is a defense, right?
Yeah.
The truth is a defense. And therefore, for Roy Moore, who by, you know, luck as luck would have it, and, you know, these issues occurred so many years ago, so there's no there's a statute of limitations that would prohibit those women from coming back and seeking prosecution or filing lawsuits. But to create an opportunity for them under oath to come in and testify at a deposition, boy, Roy, we can all just hope that Roy Moore goes ahead and carries out his threat to sue.
Well, it's all a matter of the polls, right? I mean, it's desperate time for him. The polls are all showing it an absolute dead heat now, with a guy who had a former U.S. attorney who had done things like, you know, prosecuting the KKK and other things. This guy is now neck and neck. Now, there's a 10% undecided. And one wonders what that 10%.
I'm just wondering, are you really undecided? This is a question for the 10%. Are you really undecided? Do you want to go with the person who is accused of pedophilia, or the person who has spent a career putting away, you know, pedophiles. I don't know. That's an easy choice. I think I can really make my mind up and go from the undecided to a decided.
Except now you have Bannon dispatching two reporters, right?
Yeah.
To Alabama to dig up dirt on these women. I mean, what is that going to produce?
Yeah.
And we have the president who hasn't really weighed in on this yet, has he?
I say come out from under your sheets because those undecideds, I don't think those undecideds are undecided at all.
Yeah. But you know, for a Democratic, for a National Democratic Party that also seems to be in disarray as a result of Brazil's comments last week, you know, they could definitely take a long stride into credibility again by getting out there and putting their resources and their energies behind this candidate.
Well, the problem with that, actually, is and you're far smarter than I am, but the problem with that is that the Democrats, if they go in, it's a deep red Republican state. Mm-hmm. So if the Democrats go in as Democrats, they alienate people who swore they'd never vote for another Democrat after Lyndon Johnson gave a "We Shall Overcome."
Yeah. Here are some little fun facts about Alabama. The last Democratic presidential candidate to win the state was Jimmy Carter, 1976. The last to even reach 40% of the vote, Al Gore in 2000. The last time a Democrat won a U.S. Senate race in Alabama was 1992. And a Democrat has not won a statewide race, period, anything, since 2008.
Nevertheless, there are mothers of 14-year-old girls who just can't stand what this is about. It's one thing to put the Ten Commandments up in your courtroom or to argue about Confederate statues, but it's another thing to say pedophilia is all right. And I think that while I'm not sure what the fathers are thinking, I know what the mothers are thinking.
If your choice is between an accused pedophile and a Democrat, that really shouldn't be a very difficult one. I would also suggest that our former president, who's wanted to go to North Korea, I say we send Carter to Alabama.
Well, there you go.
You know, I was reading an interesting article about evangelicals in the Deep South and the practice of cultivating young wives among certain segments of the evangelical community. So in other words, as Moore has said, you go to the parents of a 14-year-old and you say, "I would like to court your daughter." And the parents, apparently in some cases, give a nod to them and say, "Sure, no problem, go ahead." And so this one blog, I guess, was written by someone who had experienced this very practice, is saying, you know, the evangelical community has this issue that has gone under the radar for a long time. And like all of these other complaints about women being abused, now seems to be the time that the floodgates are opening and all of this stuff is rising to the top. And if you're an evangelical in one of those states, I think there's an old saying in the Bible that says, what you do in secret will come out in public eventually. And so I think there's an other aspect to this that we're just basically, those of us in the Northeast, just don't understand. But it happens in the South.
Yeah. We want to go some letters. I just want to read this real quick about, there's an article in, is it 538, that is looking about how Jones can win in the race. And so how can he win? Assuming turnout rates among different racial groups in December resemble past elections, Jones would need to win about 90% of the two-party black vote and about 35% of the two-party white vote and 70% of the non-white, non-black two-party vote. Basically, Jones needs
70% of the non-white, non-black
two-party vote.
Okay.
Basically, Jones needs to secure a much, much larger percentage of the white vote than Obama in 2012. As far as the demographics, the black electorate in Alabama basically guarantees a Democratic pathway to about 35% of the vote, but with such an entrenched electorate and so few swing votes, it's hard for a Democrat to get in the 40s, let alone win a majority. You can also look at the path in geographic terms. First, if Jones is given the areas that Clinton won in 2016, Clinton won a group of small, rural, heavily black counties in central Alabama that are part of the so-called Black Belt. She also won the counties that include the state's largest cities, Montgomery and Jefferson, which includes Birmingham, the latter of which is a majority of black. That got her 34% of the overall vote. And where would the remainder of the votes come from? It's usually not wise to compare primary elections with the general since those two are so different, but it's worth looking at the September GOP primary between Moore and the sitting U.S. Senator Luther Strange. Strange's voters might be more willing to abandon Moore in the general or just say home, and those coming from population-rich Jefferson County as well as Madison County. So there is a path, but it's not easy.
The path are people staying home for Moore.
That's right.
That seems to be the only path.
Well, there's also...
And that's what I wonder if he also... Is that what is included in undecided, as not to who you're going to vote for, but if you're going to vote?
Yeah.
There's also this... I don't know how to describe it, but I know it exists every once in a while, which is, we're going to put you right on your behind system. So in Massachusetts, where I live, which is the bluest of all blue states, right? Which regularly elects Republican governors. Because we don't like what you're throwing at us, Democrats. Mm. And so every once in a while, I'm going to scratch an itch that exists in my psyche somewhere. I'm going to tell you to go to hell. And that may work in this election for the anti-Moore vote.
Yeah, that's the only thing you can really do, right? If Democrats are the functional equivalent of communists in Alabama... You know, you're not going to want to have a strong presence there, as you said, Alan, but worked on a campaign to keep people home.
What about women? Does the 538 mention anything about women? Because I think that's what we saw just recently in the election, was that the women came out in force for the Democrat. And
Virginia.
Sure. There was a large margin. Women very, very much carried the day, I think.
So
what about women?
I love watching the cable networks to see what they're up to. And sometimes I love what they're up to. This morning, they found two white women, suburban white women, who they interviewed who were going to vote against Moore. You know, they could have found, you know, a lot of people on either side. But they don't endorse, of course, but this is as close to an endorsement by finding these right people to... You know.
Well, how far did they have to look to get them? That's what I'm...
Well, that's right. That's right.
Let us take a break. When we come back, we will continue. Alan has some letters. We'll get to those, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Monday morning, the 13th of November, 13 minutes before 10 o'clock. District Attorney of Albany County, David Soares, is with us. We also are pleased to have the chairman of the Capital District Latinos, Dan Irizarry, with us. Dan, good morning. And Alan Chartok is here, who is about to read us some of the letters that we've received this morning.
Right. Okay. Here's one from Naomi, who says, "Dear panel, what is the entire legal profession doing about our higher courts being hijacked by white supremacists, religious nuts, for the lack of a better word? Where are the safeguards? We're losing our democracy, the Trump slash Pence cabal." And that's from Naomi in Beacon. Now, this is a very interesting story because, David Soares, we are seeing that the American Bar Association is taking these nominations from the White House and saying these people are unqualified to serve. Some of them have never tried a case.
This is the most amazing thing that we're experiencing right now. I mean, the Trump administration will last 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. The term of a president lasts 4 years. The decisions that the presidents make in terms of who they nominate last a lifetime. And this idea that we have our Republican Senate just literally approving people that I've never seen the American Bar Association just...
No, they're very cautious.
They're very, very cautious. They're very deferential. But for them to say unqualified, and for our representatives to just give the thumbs up for these people, some of them haven't practiced as lawyers. They haven't practiced. They've been bloggers. They've been... part-time academics, but have not practiced law.
And by the way, David, this is where you have to be careful when you make a bargain, because the Democrats, in order to get their people through, gave away, you know, the idea of the filibuster for these lower courts, and now it's just a matter of getting the 50 votes.
50 votes, and again, you know, we'll look back upon this moment in time. Because there's so many things that hang in the balance. We're talking about it's not as if we're going to stop talking about gun rights, the Second Amendment. We're not going to stop talking about the Second Amendment. We're not going to stop talking about whether or not internet, you know, platforms are actually human beings with First Amendment rights. We're not going to stop talking about campaign finance. And these decisions are made, you know, at that level. You know, it's not the Supreme Court that weighs in on all of these decisions. It's the circuit courts that make a lot of our laws. And so the idea that you're going to just put people on there that you're choosing who have no qualifications, it's a dangerous proposition.
So there are people all over the place who are asking the following question. Well, what can be done about that? I mean, does he just have his way? Or do people have to flood their representatives with telephone calls to say their senators put a stop to this?
Well, that's what you're saying right now. That's a great question, right? Because I think if it was anything else that Trump was doing, you'd have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, mm-hmm. wearing pink hats, you know, flooding the streets of Washington, D.C. And yet, this is an issue that's going relatively silent. Mm-hmm. It's so quiet that you can't even, there's not even a bird chirping in the hallway mm-hmm. as these nominations are being approved. And again, the consequences of these decisions last a lifetime. These are lifetime appointments.
And they're appointing young people, by the way, to these jobs so that they'll be
Absolutely.
There forever. Dan, you know a great deal about the Hispanic community. These judges are going to be making decisions about whether somebody is legally or illegally grabbed off the street and put into the back of a car.
Well, I can tell you that I can make an educated guess about the diversity of these appointments.
Yeah.
Can you? Alan?
Yes.
Do you think that they're, you know, reaching out for black and Hispanic
Absolutely
judges?
Absolutely not.
I don't even think they're reaching out for women.
Or women. That's right.
But as we know with Clarence Thomas, you can always find
That's
somebody.
That's true. No, it is a chilling idea. It is a chilling idea because also questions of gerrymander, right?
Absolutely.
These lawsuits are brought up at the local level and then they wend their way up, right? So you have these guys just waiting for these things to come up. So they could smash them.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I mentioned that in an earlier commentary today. And the Supreme Court is going to come down on the gerrymander question. But then they're going to keep sending stuff back to the lower courts
exactly.
to decide. And those are going to be those judges who are being appointed right now.
And if you think about just about every single act, executive action that Trump has signed on, I mean, the only institution standing in the way of mm-hmm. his immigration policies
have been
those judges who've had enough courage from different circuits, Hawaii,
yep.
San Francisco, looking at these cases and saying no.
So if we have a president who's interviewing prospects for DA, right?
U.S. attorneys, which is another frightening proposition.
Do we think that he's going to stop there and not maybe interview some of these judges? Or call them up in a pinch and say, hey, by the way, if he called up Comey and asked him to come to dinner.
And he wanted a loyalty pledge.
Do we think that this is not going to happen? Yeah. I got news for you.
It's a frightening proposition. And I think that people at some point, we're just going to have to stop with all the partisanship and say, and ask ourselves, what are we allowing to happen in our country right now?
That, by the way, is what Harry Belafonte said before that crowd, which he said, what are we doing? You know, why aren't there people in the streets? Why is there this sort of quiet that's happening? And he was very upset about that.
Well, you know, the thing is, even if you're a Republican or even if you're a conservative, you're not winning. The dilution of those boundaries that separate the powers of our branches of government,
you're not winning when there's dilution, when there's a dilution mm-hmm. of those boundaries. Mm-hmm. You're not winning when the executive branch is literally looking to influence everything that's happening in our judiciary. Mm-hmm. You know,
Tracy says, what world leaders, certainly iconized in many photographs, sat with Stalin? They didn't know what he was all about. I know different times, different historical events, but sometimes maybe history repeats. Well, I think that's a little bit of a reach. I think everybody knew who Stalin was. I suggest mm-hmm. that. But Stalin was committing the resources to win the mm-hmm. Second World War, while other countries didn't begin to put their people on the line the way that Stalin had. Now, if you think I'm speaking pro-Stalin here, forget about it, Jack. You know, I'm not.
But a whole lot of Russians died.
Well, what was Roosevelt mm-hmm. going to do? Mm-hmm. What was he going to say? You know, we don't want that. Stalin was furious with everybody else because we wouldn't open up that second front
yeah.
while his people mm-hmm. were dying.
That's right.
And you know, with respect to both wars, I think our country was practicing isolationism. And, you know, you would think that we would have learned the fact that that we are a global community. And, you know, it is up to us in the United States to continue to beat back the spread of communism. And, you know, in this instance, the spread of radical behavior that we're seeing growing in a variety of different countries, because we're seeing it happen right now in South America as well,
sure.
which should frighten everyone.
Right. And another thing nobody's talking about, what's going on in Latin America.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for that. Eric says the informal processes rule the White House, his tweets, off-the-cuff remarks, and his use of people in informal positions to implement policy, Kushner, etc., are the direct line to what Trump believes and thinks. His measured statements and attempts to implement order mean nothing. That's from Eric. And Jerry says, Kim Jong-un called Trump an old lunatic, but Trump, in his latest tweet, only objected to being called old. Does this mean he agrees with the lunatic part? Very clever, very clever. Luke says, please, 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 all in capital letters, do not refer to Breitbart's employees as reporters. Please, and thank you.
So noted.
And Daisy, our friend Daisy, says, are also showing that polls more from Daisy. Okay. Are also showing that his numbers were starting to slip before women came out. Amazing night Saturday, Alan. That's Harry thing. Thank you. My husband and I can't stop thinking about it. And Daisy. Yeah, it was unbelievable. Okay. Christopher says, Chris from Albany says, Alabama election. The Democrats should put money and effort into Alabama, not to try to change minds that won't change, but to mobilize Dems. Jones can win if enough potential more voters stay home. And we've mentioned that here today. And that may well be because there are different ways to vote. We all know it. One way is to cast a ballot. And another way is to, you know, vote with your feet, not go.
I think what we're seeing here right now with the you know, the margins being so close in the Senate between Democrats and Republicans. I mean, I think when the head counts are so close, I think we just see an abandonment of ethics and
any
morality
principle.
And principles. Yeah. And you know, I know that there's a number of senators who have distanced themselves from this guy.
But the problem is that the ones who are leaving speak out. The ones who are staying are deathly afraid of getting primaried and getting kicked out. Mm-hmm. And there's so little profile in courage that we see here. And we know from the ones who are being kicked out that the ones who are staying also despise Trump but are afraid to say it.
Where is the bottom here? You're talking about allegations of pedophilia. Where is the bottom? Where is that line that you say, you know what, you know, we just can't go there?
You know what? Joe McCarthy reached the bottom. You know, you got to assume that the American people at some point say, this is unacceptable. And we see it in the polls. I mean, people really have grave questions about the president.
I think Nancy Pelosi the other day at some news conference really pegged what should be the Democrat talking point and slogan from here on out, and that is checks and balances. We have to stop through checks and balances what we have not been able to do thus far, because we need a bulwark against some of these policies and some of the things that are happening, and that is getting a majority in one of the houses.
We're going to take a break there. When we come back, we will continue. We want to talk about the Berkshire Museum, among other issues. Ray Graff will have our news, and we will continue our program right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. And we have other issues to discuss. Big news story happening in the Berkshires, where today, Sotheby's was expected to sell several works of art, including two from Norman Rockwell. The sale was expected today. However, due to a large push from Attorney General Maura Healey, as well as many protests from people who were against the sale for a variety of reasons, I'm calling for the sale to be put on hold, who had mass demonstrations at both the museum and at Sotheby's over the weekend, learned that right now the sale has been put on hold for at least a 30-day pause, secured late Friday through intervention by the Attorney General. And it is no guarantee that the museum will not prevail in the Massachusetts Appeals Court. But for now, the landscape shifts and the museum and its critics are regrouping in advance of its next legal task. A decision by Joseph Traynor to halt museum sales Monday at Sotheby's led the auction house to quickly remove seven works from an exhibit at its New York City headquarters.
I have a prediction. I predict, and I need David Soar's insight into this, but I predict that if this gets
it's on you.
If this gets to the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts, there is no more liberal court in the nation, as far as I'm concerned. They're going to find a reason to tell the Berkshire Museum, no, you may not sell Rockwell's stuff. He gave them to you for a particular reason. The Attorney General is acting within her purview as somebody who is looking at the not-for-profits and what happens. I think as it gets up to the top, the chances are that this thing will be the Berkshire Museum, which is making a rather spurious argument. They published an editorial of their own this weekend in which the chair, Ms. McGraw, I believe it is, said that they've tried everything and they can't raise the money. To which I said in my earlier commentary, then find somebody else. Because apparently, the Norman Rockwell Museum can raise the money, the Tanglewood people can raise the money, the Jacob's Pillow people can raise the money, WAMC can raise the money, for some reason they can't. So you don't have the right people working for you. You need the right people who can raise the money. Now, David, what I wanted your comment on was not that over the dicture.
That sounds to me like it's going to be written in the ultimate decision from the highest court in Massachusetts.
I thought he was hitting you up for cash there for a minute.
I don't mind that, but I was, but I was in fact asking about whether courts have a character. In other words, particular courts have character. You get to the lowest court, a very good judge, Agostini, argued that there was no problem with the law here, that they could go ahead with the sale. Then you get to the next court, finally get to the top court. These courts have reputations, and don't they?
You know, what happens if you're, sitting and having to make these decisions from the top court, you have the luxury of having to review every possible argument, right? You're going to have an opportunity to review from both parties, and as well as you're also going to have the opportunity to have read the editorials and see where the public at large is coming in and weighing in on these issues. And so I agree with you. I tend to think that by the time all of these arguments have been made, the appellate process, every single opportunity to have these discussions in higher courts take place, by the time every single editorial has been written, they will arrive in some space that I agree with you will have.
But it's so interesting, Joe, because I can't talk to anybody on the street who doesn't think this is a travesty, this business of selling the Rockwells, which was given so that they would in perpetuity be available to people. But there is a political class in Berkshire County, many of whom, and they're my friends, have endorsed the right of the museum to go ahead with this. And I don't know whether we're talking here. I just don't know what the motivation is. I'm totally puzzled by that. It may well be that what we have talked about so many times is you got to have some cash to play, or whether campaign contributions and the potential, even the potential for campaign contributions are in play here. But I don't get it. How can a political class be that separated from the MOS, the man and a woman, or WOS, the woman in the street? I don't get that.
At the risk of bringing this off the rails here, I was really struck by your conversation with Congressman Richard Neal in Congressional Corner last week, in which you asked him about this issue, and he said that he demurred, didn't say he wanted to give a side, and then went on to basically say that the art should stay in the community. If it was meant to stay in the community, it should stay in the community. Can he go? My point is that it would seem that would have some political clout in this argument.
Well, first of all, you have to know something about Richie Neal, who I really think is the best. This is a guy who has the political instinct to put his finger up into the air and know which way the wind is blowing. And why in the world would you tick off the huge population, all of whom, and I think almost all of them, are really for saying this is ridiculous that you're going to sell the birthright of this museum and get it out that way. I mean,
it is shocking that it's gotten this far, where you would just think there would be much more clamor to keep this piece of art, you know, at home.
Well, when you say much more glamour, David, I got to tell you, I live over there, and you can't walk down the street, or you meet a dog on the street, and they're going to say, roof, 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 what about the art sale? There is no bigger story, but what I'm amazed about is how it's jumped the state lines. Mm. So every major art organization has stepped into this and say, this is not what we do. This is hurting all of our credibility here. And so this is, and it's regularly in the New York Times right now. So my feeling is this is now a trendsetter for an awful lot of organizations who might consider selling these guys.
It puts at risk, right? Yeah. What so many people have been defending for so long. If you can see it happen in one place, then you start to fear it can happen anywhere else.
You bet.
I also think it's interesting to hear the Sotheby's, the quotes from Sotheby's, because, I mean, this is cha-ching for them, right? I mean, why would they? They don't want to screw that up. But it's so they've been very careful in their language, but it's an interesting place.
Well, you know what they want, of course, as you just indicated, they want to sell it. They want to sell the stuff because this is a very dangerous precedent. They go around and they make deals with people, and now all of a sudden, you know, people are going to be afraid to make those deals with them. Anyway, here's another one. From Gary, as much as we don't like it, Roy Moore will win the Senate seat in Alabama. We are imposing New York values on this race. I don't want to say it's normal in Alabama, but 30-something men with underage girls is more tolerated in Alabama than New York. And that's from Gary.
Boy, well, that's a frightening.
Hide your daughters. Yeah,
that's a frightening commentary.
And Laurel says a shocking fact. Thank you for the last fact about the courting of a 14-year-old girl as a potential wife. It's an incredible and awful thing to hear. It kind of took my breath away. But this is cultural reality, and these are social forces we need to understand to name in order that they be addressed by reasonable people. And that's from Laurel in Rosendale. And John says, if Democrats come storming into Alabama, it will unite. I said this. It will unite Republicans to hold their noses and vote for more. Better to quietly encourage them to stay home or write in strange. Write in strange.
Well,
you know, a lot with that.
Well, don't you think the Democratic Party then should take a page out of the Russian playbook and figure out how to target using social media platforms and figure out how to put information out there and target the prospective more voters and hopefully keep them at home?
Don't you think that both sides are doing that right now? I was eavesdropping in the patisserie downtown, thinking Great Barrington the other day, and I heard a wonderful businesswoman saying to somebody else, it's all social media now. It's all social media. It's interesting because everybody understands the potency of this thing, you know, and how it's being done.
The greatest battle that we are going to witness in the course of the next year is the effort of Congress to impose regulation on these gigantic social media conglomerates.
What do you think?
And I can tell you right now, the law enforcement community has been quietly waging our own war against companies like Apple, companies like Samsung, because of the encryption. We can't get into the phones of criminals. I mean, that's the reality right now. And we saw
the most recent a Texas shooter
with the Texas shooter. And, you know, the companies have really staked out this, you know, ground where they're trying to pitch this issue as one of privacy. But the reality is, with a warrant showing probable cause signed by a judge, I can take your blood. We can do body cavity searches. And this idea that Apple has a greater privacy interest, or is advocating for your privacy interest on what's on your phone, is just absurd.
Jennifer says, "Hello, panel. Reza Aslan, author, scholar, and professor, has written an article about what he calls the dangerous cult of Donald Trump. Aslan writes, the cult leader is generally believed to possess special knowledge. No matter how demonstrably false his pronouncements, they become by definition truth for his followers. Trump has been spectacularly successful at getting his supporters to believe his blandishments rather than their own eyes." Okay, thanks for that. Jody says, "Alabama only changed the minimum marriage age to 16 in 2003. Previously, with parental consent, marriages of girls 13 and 14 were not exactly commonplace but accepted. So you've got to add that to your equation." Mandy says, "Would DA Soares explain the fresh complaint doctrine that makes a victim's contemporaneous statements about sexual assault different than other crimes the 14-year-old victim told friends 40 years ago what Moore did to her? Thank you."
Well, the bottom line is that the statute of limitations just could prohibit any kind of new complaint from arising. There's issues in most states. What you have now is if something happened to you when you were a child, the clock starts ticking the moment you arrive at the at adulthood, and therefore you can begin to look at that clock and say, okay, 4, 5 years, 10 years in some states after that point of adulthood, then you can resurrect a complaint. But in this instance, I think it's common knowledge that the victims are left without.
But what is interesting, I think, is that society has its ways. So that, you know, movie stars, they're withdrawing their movies. This is happening. Yeah. People's careers are over.
There's the court of law where there may not be any relief, but there is the court of public opinion, which I think will continue to punish as it sees fit. We can only hope that the signs of that punishment arrive sooner rather than later for Mr. Moore.
Denise writes, "Puerto Rico. I am very afraid that the dire situation in Puerto Rico is slipping from the headlines. I've heard nothing on the news about the march taking place in D.C. this coming Sunday, where keynote speakers include our own Lin-Manuel Miranda and San Juan Mayor Carmen Cruz." And that's from Denise and Sorgatis. Dan?
60% of the island remains without power. 60%, Alan, 2 months after Hurricane Maria. Yeah. Where else would that be tolerated, I dare ask?
Yeah, you know, and that's one of those, that's the real collateral damage here of so much media today, is that, you know, what's today's story can just really be thrust from the front pages And there is a struggle to really keep the focus on these issues. My wife and I walked into the gym yesterday afternoon, and it was the same time we walked into the same place last week, and there was the mass shooting in Texas. And this week, we're walking in looking at the same screens, and we're back to, you know, football and big
barbecues.
Like
it never happened,
right? Yeah.
Almost.
And Peter says, for your information, Alan and others, as was pointed out yesterday on Meet the Press, there is a legal distinction between pedophilia and molestation based on age. Moore is accused of molestation, not pedophilia.
Wow.
I think we're just speaking
in
plain terms here.
There have been a lot of articles about this, and it does, I mean, you know this better than anyone as far as the distinction of and state law, but by most of having sexual relations with a minor is considered pedophilia.
Yeah. And the problem here is that are you really trying to split hairs on this particular subject? And I understand why there would be an interest in doing so and you know, raising to the forefront the cultural values of Southern, mm-hmm. you know,
Morris.
It's please. I don't want to hear any of that. We're talking about a 14-year-old child, and we're talking about a 30-some-odd-year-old prosecutor. Okay,
there are women in Alabama who might not be talking to pollsters, but I have a feeling that they're going to be the ones to determine what happens ultimately.
That's what this is
Alabama.
About.
By mm-hmm. the way, both bad.
Yeah,
molestation.
Yeah,
pedophilia. Horrible.
Yeah, which label would you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who joined us, everyone who wrote a letter, and of course our wonderful panel, David Soares, Dan Arizari, Alan Chartok. Thank you all very much. I appreciate you being here. We'll continue our program after this short break.
And thank